From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Christianity might have gotten its start in the Middle East, but the region's Christian minority is finding the area more and more dangerous when it comes to practicing their beliefs. The rise of the Islamic State has only exacerbated the problem. When ISIS captured the mainly Christian city of Karakosh in northern Iraq last year, the remaining civilian population was given the choice: convert to Islam, pay a special tax, or face execution. Other Christian settlements were given the same choice. Since the start of the Syrian civil war, about one-third of that country's 1.8 million Christians have fled. In Iraq, there are perhaps 500,000 Christians remaining, down from about 1.5 million in 2003. But these declines are part of a long-term trend. In 1910, Christians were about 14% of the population in the countries we think of as the Middle East. Today, they're about 4%. With some predicting they may vanish altogether from countries like Iraq over the next decade. Still, the number of Christians is rising in some parts of the Middle East, particularly through immigration to the oil-rich Gulf states like Saudi Arabia. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the future of Christianity in the Middle East. Joining us today from Washington, D.C., Nina Shea. She's the director of the Hudson Institute's Center for Religious Freedom. From British Columbia, Paul Rowe. He's a professor and coordinator of political and international studies at Trinity Western University. And from Paderborn, Germany, Nuri Kino, an Assyrian journalist and documentary filmmaker who now runs A Demand for Action, an organization that helps minorities in the Middle East, particularly Christians in Iraq and Syria. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Nuri Kino, give our listeners just a little bit of information about your ethnic group, the Assyrian group, which is a minority in northern Iraq and northern Syria. How long have they been there, and what, you know, what sort of characterizes them?
Well, the Assyrians, who also are called Syriacs and Chaldeans, in Iraq, in the heartland, in the Nineveh Plains for 7,000 years. And the same goes for Syria. Actually, the name Syria comes from Assyria. Or Assyrians. And what we are seeing now is that we are facing yet another genocide. And nearly all Assyrians were eradicated. And the remaining population of our nation are now vanishing from Syria and Iraq, and it's heart-wrenching. It's devastating.
So I'm sorry. So the Assyrians are Semitic people. They've been in this part of the Middle East for thousands of years. They're Christianized, actually, in the first centuries after Jesus and the apostles. And they speak Aramaic, not Arabic, indigenously, then. Is that correct?
Yes. We speak the mother tongue, the tongue of our Lord Jesus, and we actually believe that we were, if not the first one, that were Christianized among those first ones in the Middle East.
And if you will, the Assyrian Christian heartland is this area in northern Iraq, near Mosul, not too far from Raqqa in Syria, and the main city, as we mentioned in the intro, Karakosh, was captured by ISIS just last year. Tell us just a little bit about what happened in Karakosh to the people that were living there.
Well, it started in Mosul, where the Syriac Orthodox bishop, the last bishop in Mosul, received a phone call from the army saying that we cannot protect you anymore. Daesh or ISIS are about to invade all parts of Mosul. The only advice or the only thing we can do for you is to warn you and to tell you to leave. And the day after ISIS or Daesh painted the letter M for Nasrani, for Christian in Arabic, all Christians gave the options: leave, pay the torture money, certain tax, or die. And most people, of course, fled. And they fled, actually, to Karakosh and the Nineveh Plains. But just short after that, Daesh also invaded Karakosh and the rest of the Nineveh Plains. So from Mosul, we had 36,000 Christians fleeing from the Nineveh Plains, about 140,000 to 160,000 fleeing in one day. And all those pictures, the images, the videos we received are over there.
I mean, you paint a very dire and chaotic picture here. Let me turn this now to Paul Rowe in British Columbia. There are other groups, there are other Christians inside Iraq and Syria who have also been affected by this fighting. Can you give us just some context here as to what's happened over the past 5 years?
Yeah, I guess one thing that's useful to think about is that this is part of a longer continuum of what's been happening since 2003. Ever since the American invasion, the Christian population of Iraq has been targeted. So they've been targeted in Baghdad, where they are fairly numerous as well as in Mosul. Mosul has been a violent place ever since 2003. When I say Mosul, I don't simply mean the city. I mean the province of Mosul, which is a larger area surrounding the city. So Christians have had to flee in large numbers ever since 2003. And this is really just the most dramatic moment in the history of Christians right now in Iraq. It seems like they've been driven in huge numbers now from the area where they are most numerous, in the Nineveh Plains.
And Nina Shea, tell us just a bit about the Christians of Aleppo in northern Syria and others that live along the Mediterranean coast. Then, what has become of the Christians, other religious minorities that live there?
Well, quite simply, Christians in both those countries are facing genocide at the hands of ISIS now, and Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups. So in Aleppo, the bishop has come out and said, the Catholic bishop there has come out and said that 1,000 of the Christians of Aleppo alone have been kidnapped and murdered. And there are now between 200 and 400 hostages being kept by ISIS in northeastern Syria, and they've started to kill them. In September, they claim to have, and they videotaped it, so we have no reason to doubt it, have executed 3 Assyrian Christians. They identified themselves as Assyrian Christians. They said their name, where their village was, and this is along the Khabur River Valley, where they were from, and they were captured in March. And then they were executed with a single shot to the back of their head. 3 more Christians in orange jumpsuits then took their place and basically said they would be next, that ISIS is going to kill them all unless money is paid. So I really want to clarify, there's a misconception that somehow ISIS will accept money in exchange for, you know, will then tolerate you according to a very old traditional Islamic formula of paying jizya, or an Islamic tax for people of the book. But that is really not grounded in fact with ISIS. What we're seeing is them crucifying and beheading people outside of Aleppo this summer in July because these Christians, Protestant Christians, refused to renounce their faith. That included a 12-year-old boy who had his fingertips sliced off. His father, in an attempt to get his father to renounce his faith, he didn't, so the boy was crucified. The father still didn't, so the father was crucified, and others were killed also.
So what you're saying, there has been this reporting that says that when ISIS takes over an area with religious minorities, particularly people of the book, as you say, such as Christians, there has been reporting saying they're given the option to pay this jizya, this special tax, which dates, I think, from the Ottoman Empire, that allows them to sort of go on living there if they pay an extra fee, if you will. You're saying this is, in fact, not the case. This is more like extortion, and ISIS
It's extortion, and it's also it's an impossible tax because they keep raising the amount until it becomes impossible to pay, and then they take your land and your women as well. So in fact, we have even examples of Christian refugees from Iraq in Jordan now who are receiving knocks at the door at night from Islamists who say that they want to have money, they want the tax, or they want their daughters if they can't pay. And these are people who have been stripped of all their money and property already by ISIS. So what's going on is more of a criminal activity. It's not an Islamic Sharia rule that is being applied systematically and correctly, even by that oppressive standard of taxing Christians. So they are being killed. There are three women who have been profiled, girls who've been profiled by the New York Times Magazine, who have been taken as slaves. And ISIS very clearly says in its magazines and its fatwa committee that Christians can be taken slaves, and they should be taken slaves, and they applaud.
Well, Nina, let me just stop you right there, because Paul Rowe, I think you wanted to add something to this.
Yeah, no, I just actually to reinforce what Nina was just saying. The jizya tax actually is a Quranic concept. It came out of the early Muslims, and it has been applied in different locations ever since. But I think to reinforce what she's saying, the Islamists of the Islamic State have actually applied it as a kind of extortionate concept. They are acting like gangsters, and they use the jizya simply as some kind of a justification for whatever demand they make on Christians. So the level of a jizya is usually, you know, calculated a certain percentage of one's income or something like that. But this is not the practice of Islamic State. All they're doing is using jizya as an excuse for extorting whatever they want from Christians and any non-Muslim minority that they supposedly tolerate.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the future for Christians in the Middle East. Our guest this week from Washington, D.C., Nina Shea. She's the director of the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom. From Langley, British Columbia, Paul Rowe. He's a professor and coordinator of political and international studies at Trinity Western University. And from Paderborn, Germany, Nuri Kino, an Assyrian journalist and documentary filmmaker who now runs A Demand for Action, an organization to help minorities in the Middle East, particularly Christians in Iraq and Syria. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. 2, 1. Nuri Kino, you had been describing the flight of Assyrian Christians in northern Iraq. Many of them fled to Iraqi Kurdistan, and there has been reporting that some of these Assyrians have formed their own militias, some of them fighting alongside Kurds against ISIS. Could you give us some perspective on that? How great is the fighting force of these ethnic minorities in northern Iraq?
Well, we have security forces, as we prefer to call them, in both northern Iraq and Syria today. And in northern Iraq, we have one called the NPU, Nineveh Plain Unit, and then we have another one, MPF, and we have one called Dveh Nosha. These are the three main ones. And they are from different political view, so they all have the same goal, but they don't cooperate in that manner. They're different units, and what they do right now is to protect certain villages where ISIS is close to, but they're not in a battle.
So, in other words, these are more like defensive security forces then.
Definitely, yes.
Well, Paul Rowe, I want you to pick up on something that both Nina and Nuri had mentioned. They both described what's occurred in northern Iraq and Syria as genocide. Now, this is obviously a word that's fraught with a number of political implications. Is that how you also look at what's going on here?
It's a targeted genocide of not just one group, but several. So I would say that the effect of the Islamic State, whatever their motivations, is to accomplish ethnic cleansing on a fairly high level of Yazidis, of Assyrian Christians, and of many of the minorities in any of the locations that they have taken over. I don't think it's wrong to use the term genocide. I think the problem is that Islamic State, on its own understanding of the rules of international combat, doesn't even recognize the term or understand the concept of genocide. So it's a little bit difficult to make it stick when we're not talking about a state authority that's actually engaging in genocide.
Nina Shea, you know, one of the aspects of this that has been difficult, both I think for the Obama administration and for the Bush administration in recent conflicts in the Middle East, is how to talk about sort of the religious dimension of this, given the historical overlay of the Crusades and religious warfare between Christians and Muslims over time. How do you see that has affected sort of the present political response from the West to what's occurring?
Well, it has, yes, it has caused a silence, really, about what's happening to these non-Muslim minorities. And in, and as the professor just said, it's not just the Christians, it's also the Yazidis and some other very small, vulnerable groups. But under international law, in international genocide law, in U.S. immigration law, we have a duty of making a priority of helping and giving refuge to the vulnerable minorities. And under genocide law, religion is a factor. So I was very dismayed to hear President Obama say that there shouldn't be a religious test. And if he meant that we shouldn't be looking at the religion of some of these people being persecuted, then that's just legally off. They have a well-founded fear of persecution based on religion, a number of groups, but including the Christian. It's really what we're seeing ISIS do is eradicate their entire presence, not just kill, enslave, or drive off every single Christian, but also to just desecrate and destroy their churches, their 4th and 5th century monasteries. I mean, every trace of their civilization, even going before Christianity. So it's a very serious situation, and if the term, if the slogan, the solemn slogan, never again, is to have any meaning, we need to stand up for these Christians. I'm not...
Well, let me just back you up here for a moment, because you were referring to a recent statement by President Obama. I believe he was talking about who would be admitted into the United States as a refugee, and the question was whether or not there should be some sort of religious test. You're saying religion should be and has historically been a factor considered for refugee status, but you're saying in this case it shouldn't just be limited to Christians, and that seems to be where some of the political debate is now, but to members of other groups that are facing repercussions now.
If you telescope out, the bigger picture is that, one, it affects other these small groups, vulnerable groups, and that is not just historical in U.S. Practice, but it's also a legal requirement that we look at whether there's religious persecution, and indeed, of course, there is. It's genocidal. But there's also the issue that Christians have been mostly excluded from our refugee policy from Syria and Iraq. Because if you look at the database of the State Department, as I have, in 5 years, there have only been 53 Christians and one Yazidi allowed into the United States as a refugee from Syria. And this is 5 years of conflict and terror.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, the overall number from Syria is quite small. Now, that's the 53 number of Christians, very small, but the overall number of refugees the U.S. has accepted is, what, something like 2,000?
It's 2,000. It's disproportionately small, though. It's 2.6% of the refugee population from this country and in Syria, and the Christians were there 10% of the population. But what's disconcerting is that the reasons for this, and the reason is because the Christians are not living in the UN, seeking shelter in the UN camps, because they're terrified of being raped or killed or otherwise harassed. So they don't go to those camps. In Iraq, they cluster around churches and informal situations. In Lebanon and Jordan, they live in slums. They rent apartments, often paid by churches or international aid.
Well, let me turn this to Nuri Kino then, because I think this is a point that we want to amplify here, and it's an important one. So Nina Shea was talking about that Christians within UN refugee camps within northern Iraq, Syria, Turkey, neighboring countries, they do face some persecution even when they are sort of under the umbrella of the UN, Nuri. Is that something that you've seen to be the case as well?
To start with, all the asylum international immigration laws of the free world looks more or less the same when it comes to priority, and that's the most vulnerable groups or the most vulnerable people. And today, the non-Muslims of Iraq and Syria are the most vulnerable people. So I find all this debate and discussion in the U.S. very strange. I really don't understand it. Going back to Christians not willing living in camps, today in Germany, I spoke to three Syriac young men from Syria who fled from Aleppo. I think Nina spoke about Aleppo before I broke up earlier in the show. and the horrifying, terrifying situation for Christians in Halab, in Aleppo. These young men are living outside of a German camp on the streets because they fear fear persecution within a German camp. So imagine a German camp and then go back to Jordan or Iraq itself, camps in Lebanon or neighborhoods in Turkey, how scared, how frightened these people are because they just fled from this persecution. I also need to add to what the professor said before, and Nina, about genocide, because what we have seen is an ethno-religious cleansing that have went on since the fall of Saddam. Since the fall of Saddam, we have more than 108, at least 108 churches that we know of that have been destroyed in Iraq. Now the same goes for Syria. In Syria, we have 124 churches that we have reported destroyed. We have
and also as significantly as I think we talked about earlier, the populations of those countries have shrunk dramatically, the Christian minority populations. But I'm sorry to interrupt you, Nuri, but I did want to turn to Paul Rowe here, because I think we also have to be conscious that there are these populations that are facing sort of enormous repercussions here, but there is this sort of consciousness as to how the conflict is framed and the dangers of framing it in the West as a religious conflict here. How do policymakers make that decision about how to talk about this conflict?
There are dangers to try. The problem is back in the Middle East, if you frame things in terms of Muslim versus Christian, it has repercussions for Christians, not just in Iraq and Syria, but in other parts of the region. I think one of the things I would reinforce from what both Nuri and Nina have been talking about, most of the Christians are not actually are still in the region. I mean, most of the refugees remain in the region in places like Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan and in the Kurdish regional administration. In all of these places, they go to places where Christians are already, in one form or another, they are a minority community. They always have to deal with themselves as a minority community. So in these locations, they become a part of a larger political game or a larger political problem. So for example, in the Kurdish regional administration, Nuri mentioned before that there are militias. One of the questions that arises for even when we think about solutions to this part of the world is who takes over? If the Kurds are to take over, for example, from Mosul, if they're the best fighting force surrounding the area of Mosul. If they were to try to move on Mosul, it has broader repercussions for what's going on within Iraq with regard to the Shia, with regard to obviously the Sunni who live in Mosul, and in particular, though, for the Christian population, who don't necessarily want to be subsumed within the Kurdish regional administration either. The same kind of problem can arise in places like Lebanon, for example, where they have gone. They find an easier home, in a sense, in Lebanon because Lebanon has lots of Christians. And the same thing goes in place like Jordan. In other places, it's more difficult for them to find a place. So I think it's important as well to frame this in understanding that this is a broader regional dynamic as well.
And Nina Shea,
can I add something?
I'm sorry, why don't you go ahead, Nuri?
Okay, quick. I mean, we have pleaded for a safe haven in the Nineveh Plain from day one, to have it as a self-administration or as a safe haven with international troops. And I met the Archbishop of Mosul, the last bishop that left Mosul last summer, yesterday, and we had a very interesting discussion. One of the best things he said at his speech was that we pleaded for the world to rescue us because we told the world our plight is your plight. If you don't show them that they cannot persecute, they cannot slaughter, they cannot kill people as they like, then they will come after the rest of the world, the rest of the non-Muslims world. Though many Muslims, of course, also are affected by these wars and by these terrorist groups, but the Christians and the Yazidis and other non-Muslims groups are by fact and proofs the most vulnerable and the most affected ones, and it is a genocide.
Well, Nina Shea, to build on that point then, give us some sense as to how the fighting that has gone on in northern Syria, some of the repression that we've seen there in Iraq. How is that affecting Christians elsewhere in the region that aren't directly involved in sort of the current wars in Syria and Iraq, in Egypt or Lebanon even?
Well, they're very, very worried and watching it very closely, of course. But, you know, just to pick up on your point about the U.S. reluctant to ignite a broader sectarian war against Christians against Muslims, that's the reason why I think it's so important to give the Christians refugee status in the West. They have a right to be in Nineveh and Syria. This is their ancient homeland. But it's the United States is simply, and the West is simply not going to defend their lands because it's going to look like they're a crusader army defending Christians. And we learned that during the surge when the violence level of violence went down for everybody else in Iraq, but not against the Christians. They continue to be taken hostage and held for ransom. Their churches continue to be bombed, and they never got their homes back in Dora neighborhood in Baghdad because even though we had 120,000 plus troops there, because we did not, President Bush did not want to deploy those troops to protect Christians. So that is not going to happen. And so what is going to happen to these people? And, you know, again, the Egyptians, that is the largest country of Christian, the largest Christian community in the Middle East is in Egypt. There are about 8 million Coptic Christians there. They're the last remaining really strong community. They are very, very worried.
Well, Paul Rowe, we do have just about a minute left. I want to ask you, what do you think any future solution might look like here? There is talk of creating autonomous regions for religious minorities within Iraq or Syria. Obviously, we have hundreds of thousands of people that are displaced, more people coming to the West every day, unclear if they'll ever even return to the region. So what does a good long-term solution potentially look like?
I'm usually a little bit suspicious of the idea of creating safe havens for Christians. For example, it potentially reinforces the problem of sectarianism in a place like Lebanon, for example. That's exactly what happened. And in Egypt, it would be something that would be a real non-starter. But in the case of the Nineveh Plains, I think there is something of a case to be made for a safe haven. The difficulty being logistically how you pull it off. The Nineveh Plains are not a particularly easily strategically defended area, as we've already seen by Islamic State when they overran the area very quickly. So I think it's a little bit difficult logistically to try to pull off. One of the problems, though, is that if we don't do something along those lines, this is a population that will depart the region and they will be extinct within, as I've read, 5 to 10 years.
That'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Nina Shea, Paul Rowe, and Nuri Kino for coming on the program. Global Journalist executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Lakshna Mehta, Adam Sturrock, Colby Satterfield, and Nicole Osuna. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.